Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I'm sitting here with Matthew Taylor, co-host of the Still Unbelievable podcast, along with Andrew Knight. Thank you for dropping into The Rock.
Hi, Clint. It's really nice to be here, and face-to-face as well. This is quite something for me.
That's right. We are finally meeting in person. You're on your way home from Lancashire.
That's right, yes.
Back down south, way down south.
To Somerset, yes.
Yes. Matthew stopped by The Rock and said, hello, we're doing a podcast. We've got a lot to talk about, I think, in this episode.
I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, we've got a lot to compare our stories. In fact, speaking of which, maybe that's a good place to start if people aren't familiar with your story. What's your backstory? We talked a little bit about this, I think, on some of the podcasts that we did before on your show.
Yeah.
What's your backstory coming out of evangelicalism?
That's quite a long story, actually, so I'll keep it as brief as I can. But I grew up in Zambia, in the missionary environment in Zambia. My mum's family comes from a couple of generations of missionaries out there, so that was me growing up. Moved back to the UK at aged 18, still very much a Christian, but very unfamiliar with what Western Christianity would look like, because I'd very much grown up in Zambia, being as a privileged white minority person, which in itself is probably a story. Then arriving in the UK, making my own way in the world, really, because my family were still in Zambia. And so leaving home for me was literally leaving the country that I knew and loved and arriving in a country that I really didn't know, finding a church, finding Christianity in the UK, which is quite a lot more, I say, liberal Christianity mostly. I mean, there is evangelicalism in the UK, but it took me a long time to find it. And yes, 12 years ago now, I think, I eventually exited Christianity. And here I am now talking about my journey.
It's got quite a journey. We were talking about this a little bit beforehand. Okay, so Zambia, that was part of what originally was Rhodesia, going back to the British colonies.
Yes.
It was a diamond mining sort of outpost way back in the day. I mean, British colonialism, that goes right to the heart of why you were even there or your family, I should say, as missionaries.
Yes, that's very true. The school that I went to was basically a school for missionary children. It was a boarding school, so I went there from a very young age, right up in the northwestern province of Zambia, within 20 miles of the border between Zambia and Zaire, as it was there, the ironically named Democratic Republic of Congo as it is now. And yes, Zambia used to be Northern Rhodesia, became independent in 1964. I was brought up in that post-independence environment. I'm not old enough to remember in Zambian independence, but I was brought up on, it's hard to describe, but the celebration of independence. Independence Day was a national holiday. The day started with singing the national anthem around the flag. I know the Zambian national anthem far better than I know the British national anthem. Mm. I could probably still sing it now, but don't ask me to.
I was just about to ask, can you please?
My singing voice, even when I was singing in church, my singing voice was never a great advertisement for my Christianity.
Right.
and the Zambian flag as well. I was brought up on what the Zambian flag represents. I could describe what the Zambian flag is, but I would struggle to draw the British flag. Yes,
right.
We know
pretty
it's
simple.
The Union flag, but you know, there's really importance about the thickness of the white stripe in the Union flag, and you need to get the thickness of the stripes the right way around. Mm-hmm. I can guarantee you I'll get that wrong if I was to draw it. But yes, so my mum comes from a family of a couple of generations, missionaries to Zambia, and they moved out. So I have got cousins who currently live in Zambia and who are direct descendants of those missionaries in Zambia. And because of the number of descendants that they are, these cousins of mine, we come from the same heritage. They're not entitled to a British passport. They're Zambians.
Right.
Because they are of Zambian upbringing. They hold a Zambian passport. But they're my cousins. But I'm British and I have a British passport and I don't have a Zambian passport. And it's purely down to the number of generations between us and the first people who arrived in Zambia. So they're more direct descendants of those original missionaries, which goes back about five generations in Zambia now. So that's the effect that that has. And what was always interesting about looking around and growing up was everybody in charge, from church leaders to people who ran companies, because my father did building construction. So he started off by building hospitals and schools in rural parts of Zambia as part of mission organizations, and ended up staying and working for construction companies, and then was building embassies and hotels and office blocks. But my experience in the specifically within the missionary environment was everybody who was in charge of everything was white. People who ran the churches, they were white. The head doctors at the missionary hospitals, they were white. All of my teachers at the missionary school I went to were white. And it really was this whole, I don't think it was intentional, but when you're bringing in a culture from outside, the only people that can introduce the culture are the people from the culture source. In this case, they will be white. And I don't think these people would call themselves racist, but the impression that I get growing up and that I had growing up and the environment I had growing up was everybody who knew everything was white, and those who needed to be taught and told it were black. And there was this unintentional racial suppression that was gone there. And it's, I think, only years later that I really, really appreciated that this was going on. There's a phrase, and it's an African leader who I think has been credited with the phrase, when the missionaries first arrived in Africa, they held the Bibles and we, the black people, owned the land. And they asked us to close our eyes and look down. And when we opened our eyes and looked up, we had the Bibles and the white Christians had the land. And that's kind of true. Looking back there, all these places that I'm familiar with growing up with, the schools I went to, the orphanages I went to, the farms. Some of the people I went to school with in Zambia are now farm owners in Zambia because they're like my cousins. They grew up there. They grew up in the missionary environment. They are naturalized Zambians because of their heritage. But they own a farm, and they're white, and they own huge swathes of land. And the people that they employ are all the indigenous black people. And that happens all over the place.
Right. So it's a power dynamic. We were in Kenya in 2001 in Nairobi, and we saw the same type of thing. I was there for 3 weeks, the first time I'd ever been to Africa. We went there to do the classic missionary thing, build a church, which we did the first week we were there. And then the second 2 weeks, we were back in Nairobi doing evangelism in slums, mainly in Nairobi, which was an eye-opening experience in and of itself. We'd never seen anything like that before, coming from very prosperous America. But one of the things we noticed, that it was the same thing, that all the pastors of the churches in Nairobi, yes, they were from Kenya, but they'd all been trained in American Bible colleges. They'd gone to the States, gotten their degrees, or the UK, and come back to Nairobi, and they were leading these churches. So even then, there was that power dynamic. Mm-hmm. Where do you get your training from? Where do you get your theology from? From American or British missionaries or seminaries, Bible colleges. So, yeah, we see that dynamic.
Yes, it happens a lot. And some of the stories and examples on the stories that I heard growing up in Zambia was Zambians who wanted to do something for their country would sometimes leave and go and get their doctor's training or their engineering training in America or the UK or other European countries. Mm-hmm. And they'll get a qualification there. And then they would realize that their earning potential was better if they stayed.
Yeah.
And quite often they wouldn't come back.
That happens a lot.
And again, you get this unintentional suppression of the indigenous population. Even saying indigenous population sounds racist.
It sounds wrong.
It's the way it is.
I mean, I spent several years teaching at a Bible college in Leeds, which has a huge Asian and African population, Bradford and Leeds area. And all my students were African. They were all from Zimbabwe, Zambia, mostly from Eritrea and Ethiopia. And every single one of them had been raised with a Western, I would say, white Protestant theology, very fundamentalist, but also kind of charismatic as well. Yet they were coming back to the UK, as you say, for economic opportunities. Their goal, as they saw it, as missional students in a Bible college, was they were going to be going out to the Ethiopian and African populations in Leeds and Bradford in that area to start churches among their own, you know, populations, their own communities, I should say. So that was kind of their missional model. But again, the whole thing was, I was the white guy up in front. Yeah. The white man ran the Bible college. Same dynamic.
Yeah. And I've got a short anecdote to tell you about how prevalent white privilege is even in those those environments. Yes, I grew up in a black country. I was a minority white person. But white privilege still pervaded the entire culture there. And to give you just a brief example, I'm 18 years old. Computers are a new thing. It's the late 80s. Computers are coming. I really wanted a career in computing. And my dad thought he'd try and do things to help me because computers were relatively new in Zambia. There were companies in Zambia who were getting ICL computers. They were a competitor to IBM at the time. So big supercomputers in some buildings. They were very much, very scarce, but they were there. And so my dad got contact details for the CEO, who was black, of a company in the capital city, Lusaka, where we lived, and got me his phone number. And so I rang him up, and so I introduced myself as a white 18-year-old and said, I'd like to come and talk to you about getting a job working for you, or maybe you'd like to stop by our house one day after work and have a drink and talk about it. And this guy went ballistic down the phone at me. He says, I do not operate like that. How dare you come and talk to me and make that phone call to me? And he really left me with my ear ringing at the end of the phone call, because he just wasn't going to tolerate some white kid ringing him up and saying, hello, I'm a white kid. I wanted to work for your company in computing. You know, let me go and tell you why it's better for you to employ me. And I never really got it. And I relayed what had happened to my dad, and my dad kind of shrugged and blew it off and says, I can't even remember what it was that my dad said. But it was years later that I think that I really understood why my dad putting me in that position really wasn't the right way to do it. You know, if I'm an 18-year-old kid who wants to have a job in a local business, that is not how you get a job. You know, and it really was, that wouldn't work if I tried it here in the UK. The only reason why it would have worked in Zambia was because I was white.
And the fact your father didn't even think twice about, well, yeah, sure, just ring up the CEO of this
just
company.
CEO and say, yeah.
You're 18 years old?
Yeah.
And you're white?
Yeah.
And he's black?
Yeah. Why would he not want to employ me? You know, the naivety of it, the offensiveness of it.
Exactly. The systemic, really racist kind of underlying philosophy
underneath
the whole
thing. The missionary, to bring it right way back to the beginning, when the missionaries came into Zambia bringing the Bible with them, this is the attitude that followed.
That's a dynamic. And this is the thing in my focus on Christian nationalism and dominion theology and all the stuff I've been working on for the last year. One of the things that's really struck me is this whole thing of, if Christianity is to succeed in its own missional goals, then other religions have got to go.
Yeah.
They've got to be cleared out. So whatever beliefs the African nationals, the indigenous people, as we say, may have had before you guys showed up.
Yeah.
They had to go because you were telling the truth. You had the Bible in one hand and the whatever in the other.
Yes.
Their deed to their property in the other hand.
Yes. And that's one of the really sad things I have about the education that I had in Zambia. So, like I said, I went to a school that was predominantly for missionary children in Zambia. It was in a remote corner of Zambia. And I was there until about 10 years of age before I moved on to secondary school. In my education, I learned about British history. I learned a little bit about American history, but I learned from a curriculum that was a Western school, white European school education. I learned about Zambian independence because that was compulsory from the Zambian government. You must learn about independence, North school children must learn about independence. But beyond that, I learned very little about Zambian geography, very little about Zambian history, very little about the history of other countries in that area. I came out of school having gone to school entirely at 10 years old, having been entirely schooled within Zambia, knowing more about a country that I'd not lived than I did about Zambia. And again, that is the side effect of this importing of a culture. And it's this unintentional whitewashing. And the other key thing about this is, while it was a school for missionary children, I use that in inverted commas, the white pupils, while they were a higher population than in the population of Zambia, there were still more black pupils there than there were white, because it was recognized as a good Western education. So people with means in Zambia would sometimes send their children to that school as well. So we had children of MPs in Zambia, or people, or other people like that. Or at the other end, there are people who needed an education, who had no means of education, so the missionary school would provide that education. So we had local Zambian children also coming to the school for this education, and they're being schooled in how to be white.
That's amazing. I mean, there's so much we could unpack in that. We could do a whole podcast episode on colonialism and the sort of how missionaries came along with the colonizers.
Yes.
I mean, I've seen documentaries on BBC and other places where when the East India Company goes into India and places in Africa, the missionaries weren't far behind as they opened up the continent. On their heels, here comes the missionaries.
Yep.
You know, so they were in bed with the sort of colonial efforts of European powers. So that's a whole other story in and of itself. But that you said you've come out as an atheist, what, 10, 12 years ago?
About that, yes.
I'm interested to find out about this issue of a worldview. So you and I were both raised in evangelicalism, even though you were raised in Zambia. I was raised in Seattle, Washington, literally a world apart. But we were both raised in a churchy Christian setting. When you sort of discard your Christian faith, do you feel like you have to replace it with something else? This is a really critical thing. I get asked this a lot, that one worldview goes, what, if anything, replaces it? Do you feel like there's a need for a replacement?
Short answer, no. I really don't, and I reject the whole concept behind that question completely, but I get where it comes from. Mm-hmm. I was brought up on this whole God-shaped whole myth that exists, and it was drummed into me from a very young age, and I think that whole myth was one of the anchors that held me back. Because I describe my deconversion process as having taken around about 3 years. But it had to unpick an awful lot of stuff. And one of the side effects of the upbringing that I had was I was a young earth creationist right into adulthood. So that had to be the first thing to go. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until that went that it allowed me to start unpicking other things. But to really get to the gist of your question, really, no, the whole idea of replacing what my Christianity was with something else. I think one analogy which I've seen, it's not a perfect analogy, but it does make me chuckle because I think it makes the point in a very good way, is you don't replace the cancer when you remove the cancer. And it's the same. You just cut it out.
Get rid of it.
And I think the Christianity is very much the same as that. And probably a more realistic way of describing it is, when you stop believing in young earth creationism, you don't replace it. You just kill what doesn't comport with reality, which is this literal biblical science interpretation.
Yeah.
Okay. And the science that helps you inform that fills your knowledge, but you haven't really left a gap. You just cut out something that doesn't work, and you're now more free to follow what science is actually telling you. And certainly in terms of specifically on science and understanding science, my young earth creationism was a roadblock, or a dam, if you will, which was blocking me in getting a full appreciation of the beauty and the intricacy of what science provides for us. Mm-hmm. And actually removing that helped that river flow better.
Right.
So that's the analogy I'm going for there.
Right.
And it helped me to understand things so much better. Mm. I didn't replace that with anything.
Yeah. I think sort of as a corollary question, do you feel like in your mind, okay, the reasons why you left Christianity, is that settled? Is that final? The reason I ask that is because, okay, not necessarily because you might have doubts, go, oh, maybe I should think about popping into church just to be sure. But this is a question, another one that comes up a lot, and that is that Christians, evangelicals on Twitter and Facebook and other places, they will attack atheists. I don't know if you've been attacked in those kind of spaces, but there's sort of this sense that, okay, so you don't believe in God anymore. you better come up with something to replace that. Kind of going back to our previous question, you've got to have some good reasons. And if you don't have good enough reasons, then you should be going back to your Christian faith. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I reject the whole concept behind that for the same reason as the God-shaped hole question. But I do get this quite a lot because you mentioned I podcast as well.
Yeah.
And it comes up a lot in the podcasting that I do, in the conversations that I have with Christians on that. And one particular line that I hear quite a lot is, a Christian or make a proposal about something, say it's dualism or something like that, because that comes up quite a lot, the concept of a soul. And what will happen sometimes is they'll say, okay, it's not good enough for you to reject what I say. If you don't come up with an explanation that's as good as mine, then my explanation stands.
I win.
Yes. And that's a completely false pillar to stand on.
Yeah,
it just does not work. You can be wrong, and I can know you're wrong, but I can still not know what the right answer is. And so if you want to run with being wrong, well, fine, run with being wrong, but I am under no obligation whatsoever to accept any explanation just because I can't work out which one is right.
Exactly. I had a guy on Twitter, a Christian evangelical troll, come after me about maybe 3 weeks ago. I had tweeted something about, it was a general kind of rhetorical question, something to the effect that, isn't it weird how Christians they'll talk about the original manuscripts of the Bible, you know, that those are the inspired manuscripts. Of course, we don't have them. They don't exist. And even if we had an original, let's say, of John or Paul's letter, we wouldn't even know it was original. So, and yet, the weird things, those are written in Greek and Hebrew, so people study them in the Greek and Hebrew, but yet they rely on an English translation and they say that's inspired and inerrant. I mean, there's a lot of disconnect going on. Anyway, this guy, evangelical, started coming after me and he was giving me all his logical proofs as to why I was wrong. And I remember one of the tweets, he said, I'm the last guy you ever expected to come across. I've kicked your ass, basically. Like, no, you haven't. We've been trying to go back and forth and posing questions, and all he's coming after me with this really condescending sort of comments. And I'm like, you haven't even answered my question, but somehow in his mind, he was kicking my ass. And you know, I'm the last person you ever expected. You know, boy, you're going to rue the day you came across me.
Yes.
What? Where is this guy? I just blocked him in the end.
Yes.
You can't have a discussion with him.
No, and I think when I first started having these cross-border conversations between Christians and atheists, I was still a Christian. And I was that kind of Christian. I was very much, this is the right answer. This is the only right answer you should possibly consider. And now that I've moved on from that and I'm now the other side of the line, I much prefer having a nuanced answer and a nuanced discussion. And the most fruitful discussions that I have are discussions where both of us accept that we don't have the right answer set in stone. There are options. Let's talk around the options. When neither of us is going to reach the end of this conversation and say, yeah, that's it, that's sorted, I'm planting my flag here, because this is absolutely definitive, never to be changed answer, right there. Yet when I was a Christian, I was obnoxious enough to suggest that that was the way to be. And having conversations now back across the line with those kinds of Christians are the least fruitful conversations I've ever had. Mm-hmm. And I have tried to take just the same calm attitude with those. And let's talk about some rationality here. Let's talk about other options and all that. And it's like, bam, no, not an option. And I'm like, but sure, are you sure? You know, if you're going to go with a dualism thing, but really, how do you experimentally confirm the conclusion that you've come to? Are you really sure that the whole consciousness being an illusion doesn't actually work? And it's like, bam, no, it doesn't. I've proved it. Boom. And it's like, really? Are you really not prepared to at least have that conversation about something that you don't say? And those conversations are just so unfruitful. And I'd much rather have a conversation with someone who is prepared to go through that ground.
Sure. Well, now, this is interesting. In your podcast, okay, you're speaking out publicly. You're talking about some of the issues within Christianity. Do you feel like you're actually attacking Christianity or Christians? Because one of the questions is, what sort of pushback do you get? We talked a little bit about being trolled. Do you get pushback from Christians? Is it possible to, I guess, have a respectful dialogue with a Christian? Or is there even any point in doing so?
Yes, there is, and I think yes, there is a point. It's basically not every Christian will hear it well. One of the most recent episodes I did, I had a fabulous conversation with a pastor in California. He calls himself Daniel the Bible Nerd. And he is a much more of a thinking Christian. And we had some great conversations about morality, about how we accept the truth of the Bible. And he's a type of apologist who kind of uses language along like, it might not be literally true, but there is truth in the story kind of thing. Right. And yes, I know that we as former believers don't really see any sense in that kind of phrase. We see there's still a lot to unpack in that kind of phrase, and it kind of is it's a good phrase for plastering over all the cracks. But when you want to have a conversation with that kind of Christian, it's actually really easy to have a good thought for Christianity, because you can poke at their ideas and poke at the things that they're saying, and they're of a mindset of, yeah, I can see where you're coming from. You know, I understand what you're saying. I don't really agree with what you're saying, and here is why I agree. And you can have that proper nitpick between each other and understand the viewpoint that each other are coming from. And that can help them just to understand our position as well as us to understand their position. I really like having that kind of conversation, because I like having a conversation where ideas can be poked and prodded in an environment where you feel comfortable and safe with your conversation partner. But to flip back to the kind of Christian I used to be and to the grittiness, the point of your question about attacking, there is a certain element of attacking, and I think bad ideas should be attacked, and I think bad ideas should be attacked ruthlessly. And I don't agree that we should pander to people's personal preferences and having those kind of conversations. There's a problem in Christianity, and it's more pervasive in evangelicalism, is that attacking Christianity to that kind of Christian who hears it is no different to attacking them as a person. The right. whole ethos of Christianity is so part, they don't see it as part of their worldview. They see it part of their being, right. part their of their identity. Personality. Yes, it is. It's absolutely intrinsic to their identity. So for that kind of individual to attack the idea of Christianity, to attack the idea that Jesus's miracles are not actually real, regardless of whether you believe in the historical Jesus, right. to attack the idea that the resurrection of Jesus didn't actually happen, hurts them, and it hurts them as though you've insulted their character. And for that person, it's impossible for them to separate those two items. And I think we should still attack the bad ideas in Christianity, even with those people hearing, because I think if we can get into them, that separation of the belief and the believer, I think it will just help them to more critically think through ideas. Because while they've got this protection screen up of not separating the belief from the believer, it gives them a wall of protection against critical thought. And I think if we can crack that, it gives them that thought into a critical thought. But my motivation isn't to convert. I put in the keyword necessarily trying to convert there, because yes, I would be happy if there were no more Christians in the world, because I think it would solve a lot. And that's a whole other podcast itself. But that's not my primary course. I just want people to think critically about what it is that they hold to be true, and to be more flexible about the things that they hold absolutely true. Because I think the absolutism in Christianity is dangerous and damaging, regardless of whether or not it is true what they hold. Because, for example, we know that it's absolutely true that there is a virus out there that is causing a lot of issues in the world there. But if you're so rooted to something that it's impossible for you to entertain other ideas, you create this staunch position which makes you into an asshole. You know, don't be that asshole.
Right.
And I think that's what I don't want to be. You know, have that conversation. If somebody wants to deny the reality of coronavirus, okay, have the conversation with them.
Sure.
But have the conversation with them from a realistic and reasonable perspective, and say, well, this is the science of why we've come to this conclusion. And this is the science of why we know you're... Because as soon as you plant a pole and chain yourself to it, you become a dick.
Exactly. You can very much become that way. And I think, too, going back to your point about how they feel hurt personally. I'm taking this personally.
Yes.
It's a personal attack against me and my identity and everything I stand for. I wonder, too, if that overlaps with why so many Christians are concerned about your eternal fate and my eternal fate, especially our family members.
Mm-hmm.
We have family members who are still in the fold, let's say, and they're very, very worried that I'm going to hell.
Yes.
Now that I've walked away from Christianity, and I'm sure you must have the same kind of experiences. So why are they so concerned about your fate? You're going to hell in their view, I guess.
I think that's a difficult one for Christians. And I haven't had the hell conversation with anybody who's really emotionally close to me. A Christian who is not emotionally close to me, who says, I'm going to hell. You know what? That pronouncement has absolutely no effect on me whatsoever. I genuinely don't care. If it's somebody who's emotionally close to me, a family member, and they feel that, I think that's a more serious conversation to have.
Mm-hmm.
And I did briefly have that conversation with somebody who is close to me. And I asked this person, I said, do you think I'm going to hell? And their answer was, I prefer not to think about it.
At least they were honest.
And they're honest. And I felt sad about that. And I think this particular person doesn't believe in a literal eternal torment hell, which probably makes the case a little bit easier.
Mm.
But there's still this whole case of post-life life is a life without the person you loved in life.
You're not going to see that person after they die. Where are they? In
yes.
hell or heaven or
yes.
just ceasing to exist or
yes.
in the spirit realm? We don't know.
Yes. But, and how can hell be such a great place if that's going to happen?
Well, if people like Hitler are going to be there. You know, that's one of the big
yeah.
arguments, isn't it? That truly evil people, Ted Bundys and Hitlers and Stalins and mm-hmm. mass murderers and all that, they're going to be there. So why are we going there?
Yeah.
I'm not a mass murderer. I'm not a killer. Mm. I've never done anything. It's strange, isn't it? But I can see why they're so concerned about my fate, especially if they think, as you say, I really think I'm going to hell or you're going to hell. So, wow, I'm concerned as a family member, someone I love and care about is going to be separated from me and God for eternity.
Yeah.
And in conscious eternal torment, if that's really what hell is going to be.
Yeah.
Wow.
So the biggest pushback I get, though, from people who are close to me is, why do I do what I do? Why couldn't I just leave and shut up?
Right. Just go on your way, live
yeah.
your life.
Go my way, yeah.
yeah.
What is the point in doing what I'm doing? Why
are
am
you
I
speaking out?
Yes. Why am I so negative about Christianity? Why do I have to do that? And there's multiple answers to that. If I'm feeling cheeky and a little bit antagonistic, I'll say, well, when you stop going to church and preaching from the pulpit, I'll stop doing what I'm doing here because the two are equivalent.
Yeah, you're doing the same thing. They
yeah.
are.
Yeah.
They're promoting their religion every Sunday, every chance they get.
Yeah.
Why can't you promote equally
yes.
your beliefs that, you know,
yeah.
you have the right to
critique the
say.
Religion. Yeah, absolutely. So if I'm feeling a little bit
a little
cheeky and a little bit spiky,
yeah.
Then that's the kind of answer I get. But being serious, I think it's a valid answer.
Yeah.
I think it's an appropriate answer to give. The other answer I'll give is bad ideas, like I said before, bad ideas need to have a light shone on them.
Mm-hmm.
Bad ideas need to be challenged. And if we look at how science has progressed, science progresses because new ideas, novel ideas get attacked. They get pushed. People write a paper, they publish it. Someone writes a paper and says, that's nonsense.
Right.
Someone else,
research.
Yeah. Someone else tries to replicate the results and goes, nah, that's rubbish. And so they try again and they progress the theories.
Mm-hmm.
New ideas get replaced with slightly better ideas. And that is the standard progression. If it works for science, why can't it work for everything else? And this is partly, it's originally started off with me being vocal against conspiracies.
Okay.
You know, I detest conspiracy ideas. You know, 9/11 happened around about the time that I was exiting Christianity. and there was a whole load of conspiracy nonsense about how the towers fell. And yeah, I spent a lot of time online arguing against those, and I'm glad to see I see a lot less of it now. But yeah, I'm sure those people still exist in their holes.
You got QAnon now.
Oh, yes, we were talking about that.
It's been replaced by something earlier. Else now.
And these ideas need to be attacked.
Right.
And the reason why the whole idea of mini nukes in the towers hasn't become mainstream is because it doesn't work. And the same should be true of Christianity. The reason why we attack Christianity is to test it. If Christianity and the ideas behind Christianity and, you know, the whole eternal soul and people can do miracles and you can pray for healing and all that, if all those ideas were really true, then we'd be able to show them and we'd be able to demonstrate them and we'd come up with better ways of praying, or we'd come up with slightly better ways of instigating a miracle, or we'd come up with better ways of showing that there's a soul. And the number of people accepting these claims as true would increase. But we're seeing the opposite. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing the opposite is because we're attacking the ideas, and the people holding up the ideas just don't have anything to come back with. So we should. The idea, if you want to protect your idea from being attacked, then that's got to be a clue that your idea is on weak ground.
Right.
You should welcome, if you've got any idea at all, if you've got any respect for your idea, and if you've got any respect for other people, and if you have any respect for intellectual integrity, then you should welcome every and any attack that comes onto your ideas.
It should make it better.
Absolutely.
That's the process of in academics. You write an article for a journal, let's say, and you submit it to peer review.
Yes.
That's the whole point of that process you're just describing.
Yes.
6, 7, 8, 10 professionals in that field will read through your article, pick it apart, and send it back to you and say, this is a weak argument, or this is a whatever, this needs some work. That's the process that you go through as an academic to make your end product better than it was just on your own research and your own merits. Why is that the same?
Absolutely.
Of Christianity.
In evangelism, there's this whole concept of refiner's fire. It's a very biblical term.
Yeah, iron sharpens iron.
Absolutely. There are so many songs about that. You know, you have to put something through the heat of objectivity. It's got to go through the heat of testing. It's got to go through a furnace so that all the crud and all the bad ideas get burnt off. And what you're left with is what works. Why can't Christianity expose itself to that?
Absolutely not. Yeah.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this chat that I had with Matthew Taylor of the Still Unbelievable podcast. It seems like an eternity ago now, but that conversation was actually recorded on the last weekend of August, bank holiday here in the UK. Matthew was on his way down from Lancashire on his way home, and we had talked about getting together. So I'm really glad that we were able to meet in person and do this conversation. Kind of reminds me of the podcast that I did a few weeks back with Stephen Tiger, which I've actually gotten, by the way, a lot of really good feedback. So thanks to Stephen for having that conversation. It's always good to compare notes and share stories with another person who's walked away from the faith or religion, and we can talk rationally. We're not bashing Christianity. We're not bashing Christians per se, but looking at the actual belief system, this is something in terms of theology and doctrine anyway, according to Stephen, it's really a lot of it. All of it really is a human, a man-made construct. So if we can separate the belief from the believer, as Matthew said, and actually have a reasonable and rational conversation, maybe it is possible to reach across the aisle, maybe not convert anyone or deconvert anyone, but at least have respectful dialogue instead of just trolling everybody all the time. Anyway, what's coming up in the next few episodes here on Mindshift Podcast? We'll get back into our chat in just a second. I wanted to let you know that the next actual episode that's going to drop is a conversation that I had with Heath Brown. He and I talked about his book that's coming out in January, I believe it is, of next year. It's in the works right now. I think he's done writing it. It hasn't dropped yet, but he's written a really interesting book on Christian homeschooling and how specifically the Christian right are using Christian homeschool kids to advance a conservative political agenda. And this is something that's a brand new topic of research. And so Heath and I had a really good conversation, kind of going back into this issue of what the Christian right is doing. And of course, that relates a lot with my stuff on Rush Dooney and the Christian right and Christian homeschooling, dovetailing, as I said, on the last episode with the conversation I had with Milton Gaither talking about Christian homeschooling and how the Reconstructionist and Dominionist piece plays into that. In many ways, it's a pipeline. That's how people see it. The leaders of the movement, they see it as a pipeline for kids raised up in this system and sort of inculcated with what they would call a biblical worldview. And that, as Heath and I talk about, involves a lot of right-wing politics. And so this is where a lot of this is heading. And so it dovetails with the conversation that I had with Milton Gaither, as well as what we see going on currently in Christian politics. And then after the conversation with Heath, I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen. I've got some other guests lined up. I'm thinking, too, of doing an episode where it's just listeners' questions. So thinking about that, if you have any thoughts, comments, questions, anything you want me to discuss, send me an email, send me a DM on Twitter. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me. You can follow me there at MindShift2018. So that's an interesting thing. Also, we've got some fantastic Zoom calls coming up. We have got Paul Kivel coming up here at the end of October for our closed MindShift podcast Facebook group Zoom call that we do every month. And then in November, we've actually got two. We have got Peter Montgomery, who was just on a little bit ago with a bonus episode talking about the Seven Mountains Dominion crowd and all the stuff that's going on around this sort of hyper-charismatic Dominion, Seven Mountains Dominion mandate crowd that supports Trump. And then we've got Andrew Whitehead and Sam Perry coming back on the 22nd to talk about their book, Taking America Back for God. And as I mentioned in the episode with Peter Montgomery, this is going to be interesting with both Peter and Andrew and Sam, because of course this is going to be after the presidential election in the United States, and nobody knows what the hell Trump is going to try and pull. I can almost guarantee he will not leave office peacefully, as Michael Cohen has said in his book Disloyal, which incidentally, if you haven't read that book, it is a fascinating case study, among other things, of how a person gets pulled into basically being in a cult. And that's what I found so fascinating about Michael Cohen's book. Anyway, let's get on back into the chat with Matthew Taylor from the Still Unbelievable podcast, looking at this issue of separating the belief from the believer. Can we have a respectful dialogue with Christians? Can we build community? Where does it all go in terms of rebuilding, reconstructing our lives post-religion?
This is the thing. One thing I've been realizing lately, I came across the work of Paul Kivel. I don't know if you've heard of him.
The name's not familiar.
But he's written a book called Under the Shadow of the Cross, and it's fascinating. It's all about Christian hegemony. Now, this to me is a bad idea that needs to be attacked, as you say. This is why I'm doing so much work on dominion theology, Christian nationalism, the Christian right, and all that sort of political stuff in America. But it is spreading worldwide, that I've realized over the last year the incredible power and reach of Christianity. And even you could say, if we're going to say a Christian hegemony model, your story of growing up in Zambia in a white Christian sort of context, that fits in with the Christian hegemony theme, doesn't it? Mm. And my growing up in Seattle and being a Bible college teacher, even over here in Leeds, Christian hegemony over these African students. So to me, that's a bad idea that needs to be attacked. But the question is, the religion that's at the heart of all that, what does that say about Christianity as a religion? In your view, the damage that it's done and is still doing worldwide.
Oh, there's so much to unpack there. So
yeah, it's huge.
It's such big. I'll make it personal for me, and the damage that it's done is the Christianity that I brought up with, the missionary culture. It was very much biblical literalism, mm-hmm. very much young earth creationism. And that damaged my understanding of science into adulthood. So on a personal level, there is that. And part of my exit from Christianity was coping with how I faced up to that. And there were a range of exit emotions I had from that. Anger, what the nonsense that I was taught and how it hampered my understanding of science. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was stunted.
It was, and it took me a long time to really understand evolution. I had to do a lot more reading as an adult on evolution because I just hadn't got it as a child. And I remember once in one lesson at school, we were handed out brand new biology textbooks. And because they were brand new textbooks, there was a paragraph in them that described evolution. And we were all told to open to this page and to grab a pen and to cross out this paragraph.
Literally, cut it out of the book.
Just knock it out. And so that when we got to that page in the book, when we're going through biology, we skipped that and carried on. And so evolution was literally erased from my biology education at that young age. And that memory makes me cross. And it makes me sad as well. And so on a personal level for me, there's damage there. I believe I've overcome it. But it takes it's emotionally draining to go through that. The other way that it impacted me is it just gives this general consensus that the Bible is more important than anything else. Mm. If there's something that conflicts with an interpretation of the Bible that you hold dear, then clearly it's that thing that's wrong. And it's, and it's back to what we were saying earlier about protection from criticism. And I think that's really, really damaging. And it's this kind of attitude, I think, which enables misogyny within within Christian homes and Christian organisations to exist. Mm. When I was still a Christian, my wife, who is still a Christian, used to occasionally preach. And there would be, when she would preach, there would be people who wouldn't come to the church on days when she was preaching because it would be a woman preaching.
I've had the same experience in church.
And, you know, and it's those kind of things. And, you know, they think they're being respectful by just not attending that day. They don't realize the pinprick of hurt that it causes every single time. The individual there notices the absence and thinks that they're not respected by the people. And all these things, and it's just like this pervasive, it's like oil floating across on water. It's relentless. You just can't stop it. It just goes out and it makes the water poisonous. And the same thing like that happens in churches. So when you've got this whole kind of, there are conspiracies we mentioned earlier when we were talking before coming online.
Yeah, QAnon and yeah, everything else.
And I think that was the other damage that it did to me, was this whole way of thinking allowed me to think about conspiracies. And I got very into, in the 90s, the Illuminati and one world government and this kind of thing. And I started hoovering those up. And I think what had happened was my Christian upbringing had either destroyed or really weakened my critical thinking, my idea to assess something on merit against a global knowledge. And because I just didn't have the understanding of the scientific method, I saw these conspiracy theories and they were in books. So clearly they're published. So clearly it must be okay. Yeah, it must be true. It's on the internet.
Oh, yeah. YouTube's full of them.
And I just didn't look at conspiracy theories with the right level of critical thinking. Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm pretty sure, that my reduced scientific understanding was a major impact on that. So when you roll that out to the number of Christians who had who've got a similar upbringing, a similar literalist interpretation, and you see it quite a lot. And so I have actually said, and I'll say it again, young earth creationism isn't just wrong, it's dangerous. And it's dangerous for these reasons. It might be innocuous for a person sitting in their room thinking that creatures are made as they are now, and that person might still accept an injection and they might still accept that a virus might mutate, but it's still a virus. You know, you might look at it in that kind of thing, go, what's the harm they're doing? But actually, when you roll it out bigger, you suddenly see there's this creeping acceptance of conspiracies. And then suddenly within the conspiracies comes the vaccine denial. Mm-hmm. And this is why the whole MMR thing of 15, 20 years ago broke out, and why we have got issues with acceptance of what works with coronavirus. And it saddens me greatly that when I look at my social media feed, the majority of people who are rejecting mask wearing in public are from Christian cultures.
Right.
And that saddens me. And all it does is it reinforces this idea that there is something inherent with some parts of Christianity that is fundamentally dangerous to society. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure that evangelism has got a lot to answer for in that context.
I think so. You're absolutely right. There's that conspiratorial air, as you say. They, in air quotes, don't want you to know the real truth.
Mm-hmm.
The earth is actually 6 to 10,000 years old. All this stuff about millions and billions of years. No. It's a vast conspiracy. They don't want you to know that America really was founded as a Christian nation. The truth is what David Barton is peddling. And so there's that in-group, out-group orientation. Mm-hmm. There's that conspiratorial air. So, yes, you're already more susceptible to conspiratorial types of thinking. I agree with that, that you see that QAnon is spreading hugely in evangelicalism in America and worldwide, actually, now among Christians, and they're more susceptible to it. That's the question, isn't it? Is why are they so susceptible to it? I think you've given us a good answer. So here's another question. Now, going back to this question of worldviews and everything, this is something I've wrestled with, and I'm curious to find out what your answer is. Do you feel like that Christianity, there's somehow, if we go back far enough, that there's some sort of a pure, in air quotes, a pure version of Christianity? There's a kernel back there that if we could just recover that, we could have something good. You know, that it's been perverted by humanity, it's been corrupted, there's no question about that. Going back to when, you know, Constantine and making Christianity the state religion of Rome, and it's all been twisted and perverted since then. But was there something pure? Do you feel like there's something that could be recovered in terms of Christianity?
I don't think so, to be quite honest.
Short answer, it's, no.
Short answer, no. But I think there's a lot to unpack there. I would love to hear what a Christian's response to that is. But I think the reason why I'm a hard no on that is part of my deconstruction is being very much a rejection of anything faith-based. I'm much more of a convinced me with a repeatable methodology.
Right. Empiricist type thing.
Yeah. So today we call that science. We could call it whatever we want. But let's have a repeatable methodology that we can use to test any idea with, and will it improve? Because things improve through increments. You never arrive at first design. We think, I'm a software developer by trade, and it's a standard thing. Never trust version 1.0.
That's
true.
It's always bugs. Proven that.
Yes, absolutely.
Every new version of Windows they roll has millions of bugs in it.
Absolutely. And I'm always amazed at the technology people that I work with. There's so many of them who are early adopters. I have never been an early adopter. No, I'm a version 3 man.
Right. By now, we should know this.
Absolutely.
Never going to work.
Yes.
Why are we still getting Windows upgrades? It messed my computer up the other day. You know, I'm getting an upgrade, and all of a sudden, I lost my mouse and keyboard. It just cut me out.
Yep.
Why? There's still bugs in the system.
Yeah, it does happen.
So annoying.
And you have to reboot during an upgrade. You know, it can't do a live running update. You know, after 20 years, Microsoft still can't do that.
Still doing it.
I know. And So things mature slowly, and faith, the concept of faith just goes against that worldview thinking that I have now. So I will say it, I reject faith full stop. So the idea of a pure version of faith is not really something I can engage with, but I would love to have that conversation with a Christian and see what they understand it. And, I guess the other challenge I have on that particular question, or the pushback I'll put on that question, is doesn't the idea of the question kind of assume that there are elements of Christianity that can be trusted, that might be real, elements of the source of Christianity that might actually be true? And I'm not sure I'm prepared to go there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fascinating study. I mean, if you read Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World, that's essentially the argument of the book, isn't it? That he goes back and looks at the historical record. Almost everything that was unexplainable, you know, diseases and illnesses, mental illness, that was demons that were causing it, or spirits in the air. And now we know it could be a chemical imbalance. It could be a physical problem or a mental illness. Science has shown us that. Mm. And he says, why can't Christianity, why can't religion be subjected to the same scientific proofs that science is? If we did, we'd find it wanting, and we'd have jettisoned it decades ago or centuries, millennia ago. But yet, here we are. We're still blaming demons and spirits and, you know, everything else. Now, here's another question then from a Twitter listener. When I posted up that we were going to be chatting, I said, do you have any questions that me and Matthew might discuss? And this person asked the question, why do you think America lags so far behind Europe in terms of shedding religion? Here we are, we're sitting in the UK, but you come out of Southern Africa in your upbringing. So we have a kind of a cosmopolitan, maybe a look at this question.
I don't know. I don't know enough about American politics and American history, I think, to feel I can answer that. But as an external observer, I do see that somehow evangelism has seeped into politics in America. And I wonder if, to rewind, I'm just trying to look back over what I see, because let me start again by talking about what I see of religion here in the UK. It's very much, much more liberal, very less...
Less fundamentalist.
There are some. They exist in pockets. And
I had a few students. And just wanted to argue constantly.
And I have been to a couple of churches, and I was a fundamentalist in the UK for a while, but certainly what you see a lot in the UK is you see, and the Church of England itself is the predominant church here in the UK, and yes, it is officially tied to our UK hierarchy. But it's much more liberal, and it's much more, I want to use the Christian phrase, watered down. I think Christians would understand what I mean by that more than atheists will. And because people did it because it was part of the culture, and it was just tolerated, and it was just allowed to do. And it had much of a less impact on politics. And people did politics for the sake of politics, and people did church for the sake of church. And I think the crossover between the two just disappeared. It's not completely gone, but it's evaporated an awful lot. And I think in America, because there's a difference in the culture, I think American culture is much more firebrand than it is here in the UK, not just in the church, but in the politics as well. And the partisan politics in America has, I think, fed into and allowed
Christianism
to get in and evangelism to get in and grab a hold, because it's allowed people to stand on a political platform and say, I'm a Christian and I'm here for the church. And it's allowed people to say, I will only vote for Trump because of abortion. And I see that. And I'm quite dismayed by the amount of single issue politics that I see in Christian circles around that kind of thing. And I think that kind of issue is less obvious here in UK and Europe. Although, having said all of that, Brexit, I think, has brought the UK politics much more into that.
Sure.
And I think Brexit has caused a divide in the UK and has brought a level of partisanship within the UK that has brought us closer, has closed the gap between us and the US and made our politics look more like what I see, view American politics. Yeah. And the sad thing is, everything I see about it, I despise.
Yeah, it was ironic to me as an American living here during the Brexit thing to see the parallels between the Trump support and ultimately election with the Brexit thing, because they happened almost at the same time.
Yeah.
And the common thread between both of them was the anti-immigrant stance, which fueled Brexit, as well as was a huge plank in Trump's candidacy.
Yeah.
The Mexicans are rapists and criminals and the xenophobia and the Islamophobia, which we're seeing more, as you say, here in Britain. So it's a concern for sure.
It is. It's very much a concern. But comparing America with UK, I wonder if it's a lot more nuanced than that. And I wonder if there are other parts of our two cultures which can take the blame rather than throwing all of it at evangelism. Although it's a very easy target and it's very easy to blame just one source. But I do wonder if there's something more at play as well. And because I remember growing up, before the whole idea of Christianized politics in America, I became aware of that, was when I and people I knew used to talk about Americans, we used to talk very disparagingly about Americans. We used to talk in terms of, imagine one person I know, he used to say, America, it's a great place, it's just a shame about the people who live there. And I'm aware that I'm saying this talking to Americans, so I do apologize.
Yeah, but we're expats.
Excellent. Good.
We're never going back.
God bless you.
Yeah, God bless America.
And,
love or leave it. We left it.
Excellent. But one of the other things was, we used to joke about the ridiculous high proportion of Americans who would never hold a passport.
10%,
who would never leave America. Whereas I grew up in an environment and in the UK where going abroad was a rite of passage.
Sure.
It was important to go out and see the world. And I would sometimes wonder if those different cultural attitudes also play a part in this, one being more looking out and one being more looking in.
Mm-hmm. America first.
Yeah, and
that
I do wonder.
Trump, thing, wasn't it?
So I do wonder if part of the whole Brexit thing in the UK has turned British culture more inward looking. I wonder if that is also partly to blame, because a lot of Christians that I know are very much about compassion in the world. For example, one of the things that the UK does is it's got a commitment of some of its GDP goes to overseas aid projects, not necessarily mission, just aid.
Right.
And it's government taxes we pay to the government, and the government pays a proportion of that to overseas aid. And I remember there were some people talking about that, certainly in the Conservative Party a few years back, of reducing that amount. And I remember there were a lot of Christians that I knew who were really concerned about that, and that was a big thing for them. And when they were talking to their politicians and to their MPs, and we were coming up to the last general election when Theresa May came into power, there were a lot of Christians who were concerned about that, and they were asking the Conservative MPs, what is your stance on that? Will you maintain that? And there were a lot of Conservative MPs who were in danger of losing Christian votes if they showed support for the idea of reducing that percentage. So there are a good many Christians in the UK who support that idea,
right,
and they see it as their God-given, if you like, duty, their moral duty, mm-hmm, as us as a wealthy nation, that we should give money to other nations around the world to help them. And maybe now with Brexit and things like that, that kind of conversation is going to be a more comfortable conversation for the Conservative Party to have.
It is amazing, yeah, to watch it. As you said, as I'm an American looking across the pond, watching literally America tear itself apart. It literally is. That's no exaggeration. We're seeing race riots. We're seeing, yeah, systemic racism in police forces, the whole Black Lives Matter thing. And, of course, the Trump, how he's so divisive. And it has literally separated friends, family members. There's certain family members that I can't have conversations with about politics at all,
because
really, it will just instantly devolve into an argument, and we'll just fall out. So we just say we won't go there at all. And you hear these kind of stories, and of course the gun violence and all this stuff. America is tearing itself apart, and you think, man, what role has religion played in all that? Well, Christian nationalism is right in that mix, the Christian right. So I see it as my duty, why I'm doing a lot of these podcasts, is to educate people on what's happening currently within the Christian right and what's going on in the Trump vote and where that's all going to lead. I mean, we're seeing statistics. Younger Christians are leaving the churches now in droves, never to come back, because of the stance, the pro-Trump stance, the pro-hard right stance, the xenophobia, the Islamophobia, the immigration stuff. So it's doing a huge disservice to the church overall.
I think the damage long term is going to be.
Exactly.
I'd like to ask you a question back in terms of an observation that I've seen about the current talk about race in America. And it's a phrase that has just passed me by for years and years. And it's only in this calendar year, this year, 2020, that the disparity has become apparent to me. And I just wonder what your thoughts on it are. As an observer of America, Black Americans are generally referred to as African Americans,
mm-hmm,
and white Americans are generally referred to as Americans.
Right.
Why don't we start calling them European Americans? And does that change in phrase, does that have anything to do with what's going on in America now? Does it unintentionally fuel some of what's going on?
I think so. There was a move maybe 15, 20 years ago in this sort of diversity training that companies were trying to put together. I remember this, hearing a story about a relative of mine who worked for a big corporation. And one day they called everybody in. They said, we're doing diversity training today. This is about probably 25 years ago. And they went through and they said, we need to call Native American. We're not calling them Indians. We're calling them Native American, African American. You know, so they went through and they said, we're calling white people European Americans. And he was really offended by that. And he got up and basically stormed out of the meeting. So here's a white guy offended at saying, yeah, why do I have to call them? It's all political correctness. And I think that's a key part of this whole story is that, for example, Donald Trump, you know, he ran on one of his planks was the anti-political correctness president. I'm going to run against it. I'm sick and tired of these people telling us how we're supposed to think, what we're supposed to say. You know, when it comes to race and everything else, everyone's going to have their preferred designation for where they come from. And so he's been able to play off of that whole thing that you just described. It's all politically correct somehow, you know? And so they're like, yeah, we're sick of being told what we can say and what we can't say. And you say a certain word, suddenly you're a racist, you know, and that's what they think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's all fueling the... He's appealing to that resentment and rage of his base.
Yeah, it's a tough old thing, that really is. And
it's a mess.
It despairs me. And my daughter's 16. She's suffered over this year, over exams and all that. But I talk to her quite a lot about politics, and we talk about politics, and I talk about various things that are in the news or in the world. And we quite often find ourselves talking about either Trump or North Korea, but we also talk about Russia.
It's all related.
It's sometimes really, really easy to find a political story that enrages a 16-year-old. Yeah, and I do like those conversations, and hearing the way my daughter reacts to some of these political stories, because she hasn't got all the poisoning of history that I've got on me. You know, a lot of the time, these stories are fresh to her, and she'll ask me questions. I go, you know what? I didn't think of it from that perspective. And I find it's both wonderful and refreshing talking to my daughter about these things, but also seeing how indignant she gets about injustices in the world. It also really pleases me, because I hope she carries that on into her life.
That's good.
And I think more of our young people need to get cross about injustice and not cross about personal offense.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely right. Okay, so this is the last question now. We got to wrap it up here. What is the importance of community? We're getting away from politics and everything else. As an atheist, you're saying, okay, I've stepped out of the fold of Christianity from which I came. As a kid, same with me. But what community do you have now? Do you have a community, and is it important to sort of find other people who you can have these conversations with?
Well, simply, yes, community is important. I think as well, humans, we're social creatures.
We need
we need community. I think one of the things about community that is often overlooked is we have the option to choose our community.
Mm.
And I think this is one of the downsides of Christianity, not just evangelism, is that we often don't get much of a choice in our community. We live in an area where there's a church, and we pick the church that we want to go to, and we can't choose who else goes to that church.
That's true. We're stuck with them.
We're stuck with them.
Unless you leave and go to another church.
And if we go to another church, we meet the same old problems.
Exactly.
And I remember... You know, there's been jokes about, because my wife and I have moved house and moved location, moved area several times over the years. So we've gone to several different churches, and sometimes it's been this joke, you know, oh, there's always one weirdo in the church. And
you might be it.
Yeah.
And if it was you, man.
Yeah. And if there isn't one, it's you.
That's right.
And it's a terribly unchristian thing to say, but you know, that was the standard joke. But yeah, Christian community is important, but communities can overlap, and we can see community in many things. And we were talking about bikes when I arrived here earlier, before we came onto mic, and cars has been my thing.
Sure.
I've got a little Honda Jazz that's parked outside on your driveway. But I've had Hondas for most of the last 20 years, some faster than others. And I had a community in Honda ownership. I was part of a Honda club for many years. I'm now part of an online group where we mostly talk nonsense about cars, but we've known each other for 25 years now.
Exactly.
We've seen all of us go from mostly single people to mostly married people, from mostly childless people to mostly parents.
Yeah,
and
families.
That's the progression that we've made over the years.
Yeah.
But we've chatted together, and we know each other. We're a community of friends. And when we're children, we make friends with people we go to school with. And as we grow up and life happens, some of those friendships disintegrate and some of those friendship bonds strengthen. You. And we have our community of the people that we know through the years. And now that I'm involved in podcasting, there are a few podcasters who I listen to all the time. Their podcast feeds will never get deleted from my computer. And you know, I enjoy looking for their podcast come down, and sometimes there will be communication with them. And I follow those people on Twitter, and hallelujah, you're one of them, Clint, and it's wonderful that...
Finally met in person.
Yeah, absolutely. You are the first podcaster I've met in person. This is the first podcast I've done face-to-face. It's been fabulous, and I hope that you are not the last person that this
we'll
happens to.
We'll come down your way and visit, you know.
That'll be great. Hopefully that will happen. And so we have this community. So this little community of podcasters. And then there's some forums that I'm part of where there are atheists and believers in communication. And sometimes those conversations are fiery and sometimes those communications are not. And there's been a couple of occasions where one individual has said that something's gone wrong in their life and there's been some issues. Either it's been a medical issue or it's been an emotional issue. And people from both sides of the border come on and say, right. I hope you're okay. There's a unity in the care for that. And that's what community is. So to go back to Christianity and to church, yes, there is community there. I don't miss those Sunday mornings when I went to church. But there is a downside to that. And again, one of the things we were talking about earlier is when I go to church as somebody who's openly atheist, I'm singling myself out. Mm-hmm. And I become a beacon, so to speak. And there'll be somebody in the church who will make me their project.
You're a target now.
Absolutely. And well, that's one of the reasons I don't go to church, because for me, that's not community. You know, community is irrespective of the position that I hold, not trying to get me to conform to a position that they hold. So churches absolutely does not provide a community service to me purely for that reason. It's a sheep flock. It's not a wildlife park where you've got every kind of thing and they exist as a bubble. And they're all dependent on each other. You know, a flock can't exist like that, you know.
A sheep.
Absolutely. And so community doesn't work for that. But one of the things that's come out from lockdown, which I didn't see coming, but I've heard it from several Christian sources, is that Sundays are more relaxed. And there are Christians who are reporting that they go to church on a Sunday morning and they come back home and they're stressed.
Exactly.
And the church experience hasn't actually been a community for them. It's been a stress enabler for them. And when they come back from church, they have to chill. They need some time on their own. They need to wind down. They need to calm down before they can become a functional part of their home family again.
That's interesting.
And, you know, sometimes the whole Sunday lunch thing is a ritual to get that stress out of the system, because there are individuals in the church who they don't engage with. It's not a community for them. They are stress enablers and they are driving stress. And I've seen this from multiple Christian sources. And I think Christianity and Christians are becoming to realize that actually they're not as good at community as we thought they were, and that there are other ways for them to do community and they need to become better. And Zoom churches has helped them realize that, because they're now going onto church as a Zoom call, and certain people are not there, and they're doing it in smaller groups, and they're having more meaningful groups over it. And those individuals that are creating the stresses are not coming on to those Zoom calls because they've got a choice and they're not there.
Right.
And so I think the first thing we need to do is bust the myth that Sunday morning church is the panacea of community.
Right. It's essential.
Because it's not. And it's, you know, and we as people who are ex-believers don't need to feel guilty about abandoning that.
Yeah,
and we don't, and we certainly shouldn't look at that as a model for the communities that we build, because it is deeply faulty, and Christians are beginning to realize that. So let's be honest about that and let's not try to mirror it. And I get what people try to do with the Sunday assembly thing. That was trying too much.
It worked for some people,
sure. But I think the reason why it hasn't worked is I think they quickly realized that actually it also came with the same fundamental flaws and fatal faults that Sunday church has for Christians.
You don't need to replicate it.
No.
Yeah.
No, because really replicating it will come with the rot as well. No, let's cut out the rot and build with what's left. Let's not try to replicate what's familiar.
I think you're right. I think there's a lot of pastors out there who are really, really, really worried. Well, they're worried about the finances.
Yes.
Surely churches have taken a hit in terms of tithing because people haven't physically been there to put the money in the plate or whatever. And then the attendance, when and if things ever do get back to, quote, normal, will church attendance go back up to where pre-COVID? I'm not sure they will, because I've noticed that too, that I used to coach American football and I took a season off this year. I was going to take this year off anyway, because of some family stuff. We had a lot of deaths in the family, and I thought, I'm not up to doing this every single Sunday morning. I love it. But now that I've not done it for 6 or 8 months, I've realized, just like the Christian not going to church, I've realized, actually, I'm really enjoying having Sunday mornings free. It was a lot of work. Get up early, drive all the way down to Chester. And you know, I loved it, but there was a lot of kind of stressful things that went along with it. And now I'm thinking, I don't know if I'm going to go back to coaching again after this, because I've experienced the freedom on the other side. Yeah. As much as I love coaching, and it's a big part of my life. But, you know, it's the same kind of thing, is that once you cut that out of your life, or have it cut out of your life, you realize, actually, this isn't so bad. And in fact, it could be a good thing.
Absolutely, yeah. But I feel I can't let this go. I'm going to have a dig at you about culture. Okay. You're an American. You've come here to this beautiful green land. You're here in a beautiful part of Wales, Wales that I actually know reasonably well, because my mother grew up not very far away from here.
Oh, right.
And you've brought American football with you. What's wrong with proper football? What's wrong with English football? What's wrong with God's own original football? Or even lawn tennis, you know? You've imported your culture here into this land. You're supposed to be doing what the natives do.
It's true. Actually, that's a funny story in and of itself. I, of course, didn't bring American football. It was here way before I got here. What actually started it was originally when the GIs were here in World War II in the 1940s. They brought their pads and helmets, even though they were leather and all that back then. So we're talking, what, mid-1940s, probably early 40s. So it's been around in this country since World War II. And then in the 1980s, when it started being shown on Channel 4, 1984, 1985, a lot of Brits just said, whoa, what is this sport? This is a whole new thing. That's when the team I played for, the Chester Romans, we're the oldest club in Britain.
Really?
We started in 1986, right off the back of Channel 4 showing American football.
That's very cool.
So we're the oldest continuously operating American football team. So it's been around as a sport for officially British American football since about 1985. So it's gone on a long time. And of course, now the Wembley games have just increased its popularity. They're selling out every time. They play 3 games in London every year. So yeah, it's the fastest growing sport in Britain, actually. So it's an interesting thing.
Anyway. Yes. I don't know if I should endorse that fact, but
that's right.
And of course, I'm jesting, obviously. All sport is great for both the mind and the soul.
Right. And so, we coach young kids, you know, so we get kids who would be sitting there playing their Xbox and PS4s on a Sunday, get them out running, and you know, it's good for exercise. Okay, last question then before we go, how can people get a hold of you? Where can they find your podcast? Where can they get a hold of you on social media?
My podcast is Still Unbelievable, as you've already mentioned, but Andrew and I also do a second podcast called Proscenium. It's a slightly lower scale podcast, but Still Unbelievable is mainly for our religion and Christian based content. We don't want everything that we do to be about religion. We just don't want to be focused on one thing. There are other interesting subjects out there besides critiquing religion. And so Proscenium is where we do other things. You can find links to both those podcasts on the website, which is reasonpress.net. And the reason why it's called Reason Press, for a quick little bit of history for anybody who's not familiar with me and my voice, is Andrew and I first got to know each other through the Unbelievable podcast, which is a Christian podcast based, run by Premier Christian Radio here in the UK. That's a podcast doing dialogue between Christians and non-believers, not just atheists, but non-Christian faiths as well. And that's been going under Justin Brierley for about 12, 13 years, I believe, possibly even longer. Originally as a radio show, and then it became a podcast as well as a radio show. And the host of that, Justin Brierley, he wrote a book called Unbelievable, based on 10 years of having these conversations, and he subtitled it, Why After 10 Years of Talking to Atheists, I'm Still Christian. And so that came out a couple of years ago. And so a group of atheist listeners, because by the time the Unbelievable podcast had been going for 10 years, there were a lot of atheist listeners to that, and a lot of atheists who were enjoying the dialogue and enjoying the conversation.
Sure.
Because one thing, as an aside, that I've discovered over the years is when having dialogue between atheists and Christians, for the atheist to have that kind of dialogue, the atheist has to go to the Christian's turf it has to cross the border and go to where the Christians are to have those dialogues. Christians coming the other way to our home, to our turf, to our places is a much smaller number and a much rarer thing. And I would love to see that equalized. I'd love to see more and more Christians coming over to us having those conversations. But for the moment, if you want those conversations, you need to go to where the Christians are. Almost like the missionaries of 100 years ago. Right.
Going back to Africa.
So anyway, so off that book, the group of listeners, of atheist listeners, wanted to do a response book to what Justin said, because we are not convinced by anything that we've heard for Christianity in 10 years of listening to Unbelievable. We still think it's unbelievable. So we wanted to do a response. So when Justin's Unbelievable book came out, we got together and we wrote a response book called Still Unbelievable, why after 10 years of listening to Christian arguments we're still skeptic.
Right,
and so that's what that book came out as, and so that book is available as an ebook on Amazon. I'm in amongst other things, I'm trying to work on a second edition of that to get a few more chapters. So if anyone feels they want to contribute to that, they can get in touch through reasonpress.net. So that's why Reason Press exists, because of that book, Still Unbelievable. All proceeds from the sales of that book go to charity. So if you pay your 99p for Amazon for that as an ebook, that money will eventually end up with, I think, an American Atheist, but it will end up at a charity. So that I don't see any of that money. And we then did a second book about coronavirus, and there were Christians and atheists who wrote that book. And again, all of that book goes to that goes to charity. So I think goes to the Red Cross for work in aid in responding to coronavirus. And that book, although that's also under Reason Press or related to Reason Press, I think you need to go to the Skeptics and Seekers website to get access to that. So that's kind of the sort of things I'm involved with. It's not just podcasting, but reasonpress.net is where you get hold of me and where you get hold of Andrew. reasonpress@gmail.com is the email address to find us. We would love feedback if people want to have conversations about anything that we've talked about. I'd love to host people on that. You've come over and talked to us on an episode of Still Unbelievable about the document that you wrote about exiting Christianity.
Yeah.
So that's how you can contact me.
Reason Press is the port of call then. Listen, Matthew, thank you so much for stopping by. I've absolutely enjoyed meeting you in person.
Absolutely. It's been great.
I hope you have a safe trip way back down south where you're going.
Yeah, about 3.5 hours home, I think, so long as hopefully the motorway is okay. But we're at the tail end of a bank holiday weekend. You know, I might be fighting with the rest of the country to go home, so maybe it'll take longer. We'll have to see.
Have a safe trip, and I'll see you. We'll come down your way next.
Oh, well, thank you, Clint. It's been a blast.